Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
My friends have a policy that if I ever start talking about Murder, She Wrote, they punch me in the shoulder.
Oh, good, right.
Because it happens a lot.
Oh, somebody get us another drink!
Sweeney Todd.
Here it goes. Coming at a tender tale, hey?
So, for me, Halloween is in 2 days. But for our listeners, Halloween will have already happened.
I know.
It's not.
I wonder how it went.
Maybe they'll tell us.
Hopefully.
Do you think anyone dressed up as Sweeney Todd for Halloween?
I'd expect so. I'd hope so. It's a great costume. Have you ever dressed up as Sweeney Todd for Halloween?
Not intentionally, no.
Oh, okay.
But I do murder people as a barber on Halloween. That's just a tradition that I have.
Right. That's fine.
So, you know, we've got that in common.
I do the same. I just make a lot of pies.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a dress.
Oh, God.
We've all got our junk.
It's true.
So, yeah, well, I hope everyone had a really lovely Halloween. Let us know what you dressed up as.
Please, especially if it was something musical related.
Exactly.
Like Patti LuPone.
Or zombie Patti LuPone.
Zombie Patti LuPone. Oh my
God. That'd be brilliant.
That would be terrifying.
I might just steal that.
Do it.
Already.
You should do it. Oh, Jimmy, everyone is enjoying right now the pictures of you dressed up as zombie Patti LuPone from Halloween that has already happened.
Exactly. That's what's happening. I've gone viral, actually.
Congratulations on your going viral.
Yeah. Patti's been in touch already about a book deal or something like that. What I find quite interesting, another great reason for us to be talking about Mr. Todd, is the quintessentially British holiday that we've got coming up across the pond of Guy Fawkes Night.
Of Guy Fawkes Night. We talked about this. My experience of Guy Fawkes Night only extends to that one Sherlock episode.
Yep. And like I say, that is pretty much it.
I believe that.
Yeah, so we like to pay homage to the man who tried to blow up the Houses of Parliament by burning some effigies of him and setting off fireworks, because we're British.
I can't wait to see pictures of you in a dress holding a meat pie, setting off fireworks in a giant...
Just in the background, Houses of Parliament aflame.
So, on Guy Fawkes Night, of all things, I was doing some research for Sweeney Todd, and Sondheim points very much to an old movie called Hangover Square.
Yes,
as his
he
inspiration.
Loves Hangover Square. Yeah.
Have you seen any of Hangover Square?
I've not. Is that something I should be doing?
Well, I only watched a little bit of it because I can't stand long, boring movies in black and white, but it actually looks super creepy. And he's right. Sondheim says his big inspiration is the score, and he's right.
Yep.
The score is terrifying. And if you listen to it 100%, you'll be like, oh my God, I can hear Sweeney Todd. But it's vaguely about a composer who is a schizophrenic and murders people when it's like kind of Jekyll and Hyde. And then the climax scene,
which sounds so exciting. Yeah.
It's amazing. He like the police come into the concert hall where he's playing his dramatic concerto. And they're like, you must come with us. And he's like, I must hear the end of the concerto. And then he sets the whole place on fire and plays piano as he burns to life, to death, even.
Burns to life. That's beautiful.
I burn to life every day, every morning when I wake up.
Every morning you arise like a phoenix.
But one of the ways he murders people is he kidnaps a girl on Guy Fawkes Night and throws her into a burning pile of whatever.
Sherlock, what did you steal?
It all comes around.
Exactly. Exactly. But no, that was obviously such a huge influence for him, and he was totally obsessed with the melodrama of it.
Yeah,
what is Sweeney Todd?
what?
On a theatrical level, what is it? Because even Mr. Sondheim struggles to define it, which I think is totally fair.
I mean, you know, you can Google online and Sondheim says it himself. No one can decide whether this is an opera or a song cycle or somewhere in the middle. What do you think it is, Jimmy?
I think it's a musical.
I think it's a musical too.
I think it's a dark musical. Should we talk about that now?
Let's talk about it now. Why not?
Are we going to go off our plan?
We're going to, like, we have a plan.
I know, that's true. Okay, wow. Well, what I love about Sweeney Todd is the darkness.
Yeah.
Because there's not, in my opinion, there's not enough of that out there. I mean, obviously Sondheim wanted to write something that was horrific and would scare people because, you know, he said that there wasn't really anything like that out there. That's what I fixate on. A lot of people fixate on the humor side of it and the more melodrama side of it. But I like to kind of look past that and think, okay, well, I know that's there, but how deep can we go? And it's really dark. And I think when you really start to pick away at it and listen to the music and kind of find all those horror moments in there, it gets very exciting, which I'm sure we will talk about. What about you, Mr. T?
I mean, I think it's definitely a musical too. I think we've had more horror musicals since,
mm-hmm.
but it is definitely, you know, we could not, I don't know. It doesn't seem like it knows that it's a milestone in that way, that it kind of opened the door for things like Little Shop or things like the, you know, The Gift That Keeps Giving, Carrie, the musical.
Can't wait for the new one that's just started.
And
they'll keep flogging that horse.
I'm sure it's not going to do any better. But like the fact that you can bring people into a theater and scare them is really cool, you know, and without like it's not. I think it's easy to do like cheap scares, you know, jump scares and things like that. But Sweeney Todd doesn't have a lot of like, ooh, boo sort of scares to it. It's a psychological thriller in a lot of ways.
100%.
I don't think you see that kind of construction in what people call musical theater.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think even Big Steve is afraid to call it a piece of musical theater, because that kind of evokes, you know, kick lines and glitter.
Exactly. And especially in the time that it was written as well. That's what people were used to, and they wanted to go to theater to see the musical comedies.
Right.
You know, especially for him, before Sweeney, people would know him for things like Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, and that's what people would probably go expecting. I don't know, I've always got a theory. I've never read anything that confounds it or whatever, but I'm interested to hear what you think.
Uh-huh.
Because I think if we amped up the horror in Sweeney Todd and kind of took down some of the comedy,
mm-hmm.
I know I would love it a lot more.
You think so?
Uh-huh. But I don't think it would work as a Broadway show. I don't think it would be as accessible. And I always wonder if that was a factor for Sondheim when he was writing it, if he was like, I want to make this scary, I want to really add the chill, but unfortunately, I'm going to need to fit in a couple of these.
See, but I think the funny in the musical, the joke songs, heighten later horror parts.
Right.
So, like, I think one of the brilliant pieces of the structure of Sweeney Todd is that they start you off at the very beginning, attend the tale of Sweeney Todd, very much implied, this is not something you want to be or agree with. This is a morality tale about a tragic hero. And then, by the end of Act One, after Epiphany, we sit through all of A Little Priest, and you go off into the lobby thinking, ha, killing people and putting them into pies. Hilarious. Oh my God, this is going to be so much fun. And then by the end of Act Two, you're like, what the hell was I thinking?
Yeah.
Clearly, this is a bad thing to do. And I think the roller coaster of that heightens both ends of it. If it was just scary all the time, you'd grow bored of it. But because you have those moments to breathe, it makes things seem more gruesome. Like, even in Act Two, is it the quartet? When Anthony's singing Joanna and the beggar woman, and then Todd is, like, just slashing throats left and right.
Slicing away, yeah.
And it's halfway between this hilarious, oh my God, what is he doing? And this terrifying, oh my God, what is he doing? So I don't know.
It's an interesting one. Just because there's no songs in it that are kind of knee slappers, thigh slappers, whatever they call them. Everything does have a kind of twisted context to it. You know, even Pirelli in the tooth peeling scene, that's just disgusting.
That's true.
Do you know what I mean? It's really, really disgusting.
Yeah.
And, you know, like you say, A Little Priest is obviously lovely comedy jaunt about killing everyone. So yeah, it is. It's an interesting one.
I think maybe the recent Broadway revival, the pared down one, got a lot closer to that kind of all horror all the time goal. When you delve into that one too much, I think it gets a little almost too complex.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
You already have this whole like framing story of, we are putting on this play for you, Attend the Tale of Sweeney Todd. And then they put that framing story inside another framing story of, we're inmates in an asylum and Tobias is telling this. And then there's this weird coffin that we're pouring blood into that is a little weird and a little ambiguous. You spend the whole show thinking like, why are we doing this? Which,
yeah,
there's use in that, but it's already a complex show.
Exactly. I have a lot of beef with that production. Some good beef, some bad beef. The direction of it I get, and I'd like some of the ideas that they did. I like what they did in terms of it being an actor musical, and they really used, you know, they used the instruments. You know, Joanna playing her cello and hiding behind it. That's a lot of good fun. That's really good. I don't know. I don't think that's necessary. And to be honest with you, I don't think it should be done for Sweeney Todd. What I think one of the main characters in Sweeney Todd is the score. It's so emotive and there's so much there. To scale that back, you lose so much. And you can hear it. You listen to the cast recording and it doesn't feel as soaring or chilling because you've lost so many of your players.
Because it's so reduced, yeah. Even when it sounds reduced on the cast recording, that's, they didn't have the actual actors play for the cast recording. Those are all studio musicians playing the reduced part. When you hear the actual actors play on stage, and playing an instrument and acting is super hard. There's a reason we employ separate people to do these things, because if you're really good at one, you know, might not have as much brain power to do the rest. But it really, it dumbs down the score in a bunch of big ways.
I also have beef with Patty. I know you
like So I need to clear up this misconception that the internet has. For those who stumbled upon our podcast and haven't seen my miscast Mrs. Lovett video, I made a video where we compared Helena Bonham Carter, Patti LuPone, and Angela Lansbury's take on Mrs. Lovett in their various Sweeney Todds. And then we pick a winner. I understand that that endeavor is fundamentally flawed, because acting is not a zero-sum game. They all can be good. It's just fun to pick one, internet. And it's my opinion, and I understand there's not a lot of justification behind that, and that's why you're entitled to have your opinion. The, like, 3,000 people who have commented on it.
And hate you.
And hate me.
The pitchforks fired.
Oh, man.
In the back of your skull as you walk down the street.
So many Helena fans. I think I must have gotten posted on, like, Helena Bonham Carter is god.tumblr.com or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think that's what it has. The lynch mob is out.
So what's your beef with Miss Patti LuPone as Mrs. Lovett?
She can't do a bloody British accent. She sounds abhorrent. She just sounds awful. No, I adore Patti's singing, and I think she has a very unique style, which works so much in many, many things she does. It does not work in a verbose Sondheim score, which has nuance and colloquialisms.
Do you think you would have enjoyed it more if she just ditched the accent and just did, you know, normal Patti?
Yeah, do you know what? I probably would. It wouldn't have worked because she'd be saying all this nonsense and...
Oh, I guess that's true. She's got quite the dialect.
The one that it's just, you listen to that recording and you listen to By the Sea, and it's just like, I've always had a dream, you know? And just pours off into it, and you're like, what the hell are you saying?
Well, there's that. It's because she's in an asylum and pretending to have a British accent.
Oh, hush, don't you use that as an excuse.
Well, okay, so this is a question I've had, is, and I don't actually know the answer, is Sweeney Todd a quintessentially British story? I mean, I know it has this pseudo-historical base, and while there is no actual person named Sweeney Todd, there's a lot of importance in the history there.
Yep, yep, yep.
But it premiered in America. Both the original Broadway and the original West End productions were financial failures, and according to Sondheim, the West End version failed even more than the American version. And so I wonder, you know, why?
Why British?
Why?
I guess just because it's set in London.
I guess that's,
do you know what I mean?
That's true. Do they just murder people more often over there?
We do. It's just, it's quite tough sometimes. You're walking in the street and swerve and, oh gosh, please, not at the moment.
All of a sudden you're in a pie and you're like, what? How did this?
Gosh damn it. Another one. Well, just go be eaten.
I always wondered this about shows anyway, but if you have a different experience going into the show, not knowing the myth that is Sweeney Todd. Like, if you go and, you know, he's just an evil guy. Oh my God, they're baking him into pies. Where maybe you have a different experience if you go in thinking, like, when are they going to get to the pie baking part?
Uh-huh.
Because you know this kind of mythic story of Sweeney Todd and Mrs. Lovett and their pie shop.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
And I think it's all, I'm going to do this a horrible disservice because I had an awful theater history professor in college. But the original production is very Brechtian in nature, which is a $10 theater word I only pull out to describe Sweeney Todd for our listeners who maybe did poorly in theater history like me. Bertolt Brecht had this kind of theater style that was centered around the alienation effect.
Yeah.
His concept was that you always want to be aware that you're watching a show going on.
Exactly.
And that you're watching actors tell a tale. And he had all sorts of ways to do this with, like, placards and loud noises and, you know, even just overtly being told that you're watching this and, like, big, big sets and things like that. And the original Broadway production, at least on the surface, is decidedly that way. It is decidedly Brechtian.
I have so many opinions on this. I love Bertolt Brecht. I really, really do. And when I first studied him at school, I was just obsessed, and in the first kind of productions I saw, I was just like, this is amazing, he's such a genius, and of course this is what theatre should be. And no, like, I'm not political in any way, shape or form, mm-hmm. which is obviously the reason why he created this form of theatre, was to educate. But for me, I was just obsessed, and obviously with that obsession, being obsessed with Sweeney Todd, the more you pour through it, the more you kind of realise...
Mm-hmm.
There is so much that links the two together.
Yeah.
The first line, like, it's instant distancing. It's, here's your Greek chorus, this is it, you're watching this tale, and we're gonna let you know that it's a tale. Even the basic fact that one of Brecht's techniques was to put songs into shows, because people breaking it into song is not in any way natural.
Right, and it completely alienates you.
Exactly.
It's interesting then to, like, when you go through whichever hat book this one's in, with all of Sondheim's opinions on it, and all of the effort he goes through to kind of forego some of those more traditional chorus roles, like giving people separate parts when we first meet Pirelli and God, That's Good.
Yep.
And he talks for a long time about the song Wait,
right,
which I have mixed opinions on, but how it at first glance doesn't seem like a necessary song, but is setting you up for the killing sequence.
Exactly.
And some of that, I would say, feels decidedly non-Brechtian. Like, he's trying to aid you in suspending your disbelief. Even, like, we were talking earlier, at the end of Act 1, you're sympathizing and agreeing with Mrs. Lovett and Sweeney, which is not, you know, you're not going into the lobby thinking, boy, those actors are doing a good job. You go into the lobby thinking, oh, they're killing people and putting them into pies.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know. The ways in which it uses and doesn't use aspects of epic theater are really cool.
It's one of the reasons why I think the movie is also slightly flawed.
Yeah.
Because one of my main, again, beefs with the movie is that it doesn't have a chorus.
Yeah, for sure.
So you're not attending a tale, you're just, you're watching a movie. You're watching a movie.
Yeah, you're watching a horror movie.
So you lose that core message of what you've just seen, this could be you, so make good choices. You completely lose that because no one's telling you that.
Yeah, for sure.
So you just see this portrayal of this man and this woman go crazy. Oh, isn't it sad what happened to him? But he's dead, so that's fine. And, you know, whatever message you take from that, that's fine. But I think with the chorus and all of the messages, all of the ballads that come through, it's just pure quintessential Brecht, and it's so necessary to feel that message. It's such a great message.
Yeah.
The last ballad is everything to me. I just think it is incredible because it's so stirring, and it's that's the scary part, is that you get to the end of the show and you're like, right, Okay.
Even just the wonderful transition right after Toby kills Todd and is like having his psychotic break. And then the whistle blows for the last time. And he goes from this, you can't understand a word he's saying, to I am calm, cool, and collected. Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd. This was a play. Aren't you creeped out right now?
Exactly.
It gives me chills. People have a lot of opinions about this show.
They really do. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Because it's so well discussed. My circle of friends, everyone has an opinion on Sweeney Todd. Everyone does. And it's weirdly polarizing. And
yeah. I think because it is so well constructed, any problem you have with a particular part, even of the construction of it, is difficult to write out because it's so interwoven. So, like, for example, I cannot stand the song Green Finch and Linnet Bird.
Uh-huh.
I hate it so much with every passion of my being because it's like, dear world, I am a girl, I am a metaphor. Oh my, what is it like to be trapped in a cage, dear bird? Won't you tell me? Pout, 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 sad, sad, sad. Oh, I am a one-dimensional female character. Like,
And it's really long.
It's really long, and it's really high. It extends beyond just the show itself. I sat through a cattle call worth of auditions for Into the Woods. 500 high schoolers auditioned for Into the Woods. You had to prepare a Sondheim song not from Into the Woods. So I heard Green Finch and Linnet Bird sung like 200 times over the course of 2 days, most times very poorly. I've heard enough of this song.
Yeah, that's your own fault. You were good.
That's true. I did. That's true. But you can't, unless you write her a new song, you can't get rid of that song. You can't get rid of Joanna. Like, everyone's really important.
It's a funny one with Anthony and Joanna. I I've got a lot of opinions mm-hmm. between the two of them, just in just how they are often portrayed in productions. Of it. I mean, I am obsessed with the psychology of their relationship. All parts of me want to believe that Sondheim wanted to do more than just make them this little idyllic metaphor couple.
I hope so.
To provide this kind of clear glimpse of hope throughout the show.
Yeah.
To, you know, not offend people too much. It's just, it's strange that a sailor such as Anthony, who's been away for God knows how long, goes off on shore leave.
And he's like, now I gotta find a girl. I know I've been around the world, but now...
Now I have to fall in love. If you, again, kind of dig into Joanna, the first Joanna, Anthony's Joanna, if you dig into that and you listen to the music, it's a really dark song. It's creepy. It's really creepy. And it's not this beautiful love ballad that people paint it as. It's really menacing. The music is dark as anything, and those I don't know any musical technical terms, so I'm about to offend a lot of people.
Me neither, so we're doing great. So,
but I want to say, you know, I don't know, discordant things.
Sure, yeah. Well, it is dissonant. It feels dark, uh-huh. And that's something you can say from, you know, whether you know one note from another.
Exactly, it feels dark. And then you look at the lyric, you know, I'll steal you. I'm in the dark beside you. It's creepy. It's creepy. If taken out of context, it's really creepy. But then it just kind of peters out a bit. And
yeah, because the next song, they're in love on their tiny couch. Like, what happened in between?
I know, and they are in love in that song. So much of me has tried to look into Amis and Kiss Me and be like, right, where is that hidden... he's just trying to rape her or something. Do you know what I mean? Something like that.
Yeah.
There's nothing. They're just in love.
I know. But it's so, what's the difference between Anthony and the judge other than we are meant to interpret the judge as the bad guy and Anthony as the good guy?
Exactly. And I guess as well with Joanna, mm-hmm. it makes sense in her book why she would fall in love at the drop of a hat from this mysterious stranger who's freeing her because that's all she wants. She wants to be let out of her cage. So he comes along. So obviously she's like, you're great. I'm in love with you because she's been trapped by herself for so long. She must be clinically insane.
I wonder if you could, because she has, it's always given as such a throwaway line, but right after they break out of the asylum and it's the marry me reprise, which is really short, but she has that like, you said you'd marry me Sunday. That was last August.
Yes. Oh my gosh. I'm obsessed with this bit, Tommy. No, you've totally hit the nail on the head. That is such an interesting shift. Spoiler alert, when she shoots fog, and it's that weird balance of power just goes poosh, and suddenly their relationship changes. Now, what would be great is if previously there was more strength and more control from Anthony.
Right.
So that we could really feel that change.
Exactly.
When she shoots him and suddenly she's now in the driving seat.
Yeah. If he has just like one moment to say like, no, we're doing this. And she says, okay. And then later on, she grabs the gun from him and shoots Fog.
Yes. And after that, and like you say at that moment, you know, where she's like, that was last August. Kiss me. And she, you know what I mean? It's just that she's in control now. She's calling the shots. And then when they go into the attic, she's kicking up a fuss, you know what I mean? She's like, oh, but where is this Mr. Todd? And I do love that on the original Cash Gordon. She sounds so disparaging. What's this Mr. Todd, you know, that you speak of? And I do love, and this might be me overanalyzing, but I love that she is dressed as a man at that point.
Oh, it's great.
Isn't that interesting?
It says so many wonderful things. It also, you know, it is, I think that is the wonderful, beautifully tragic part of the show, even more than Todd killing Lucy, is Todd meeting his daughter and having no idea, to the point of threatening to kill her, and then never knowing and dying before he ever finds out that they met. It would be even like, it is tragic that he learns that he killed Lucy, but at least he gets that closure. But with Joanna, he never, ever, ever sees her ever, ever, ever again and spends the whole show trying to.
But then it is interesting the way that he starts to get distance from her. And I love in the Joanna quartet when, you know, he is just totally going through the motions and it's so beautifully done. This lovely, nice little rum-dum-dum-dum score where you're just kind of plodding along and he's just plodding along, doing what he's doing. And everything he's saying as well, I think I'll miss you less and less as every day goes by. I think I'll get over this.
Yeah.
I still love you, but I don't care nearly as much anymore. And, you know, it's so interesting that it culminates with him seeing her, not having a clue, not responding in any way, and just being like, well, I'll just kill you as well. He's totally lost sight of why he's doing anything.
Exactly. And that's what's great about it. And that's why weight is so important, no matter how much I want to cut it. Because there's, if you read through, they cut often both the judge's intro song, which I think is also called Joanna, because that was the thing Sondheim wanted to do.
Yep.
And then the tooth-pulling sequence are cut from Act 1 because there's a real big lull right there. And then the next thing we go into is weight.
Yep.
And it seems like, well, if that was your problem, why not cut weight, a song that Mrs. Lovett sings about not doing anything, and let's introduce the judge and let's give Pirelli his more time. But weight helps inform everything Todd doesn't do the rest of the show. Embrace your revenge, embrace your murdering, wait for it, enjoy it. And then he does, and, you know, man, does it bite him in the butt.
I thought it was a really interesting song in terms of its placement between the kind of balance of power between Todd and Lovett, because that, I guess, is the first time that she starts to get control and she starts to really kind of take over in his life.
Yeah.
And that's the first time that she gains that influence. I think it's a bit weighty. I think she has maybe a bit too much influence at that point, but hey, you need to tell the story.
I wonder what a production without weight, how that would actually read. Like, if people would be like, why are we, you know, just kill the judge, just kill the damn judge. Why are we singing?
Exactly. And it would affect their relationship. It would ruin everything.
Yeah, it probably would.
I don't want people to go away from that show thinking, oh, but it's okay because Joanna and Anthony are together and they'll be happy. They will not be happy.
I think I would much rather see this story retold not with Tobias as the narrator, but with Joanna as the narrator.
Right.
Or like Joanna and Anthony, like, we got out, but man,
I want that fan fiction.
Wouldn't that be wonderful?
You know what I mean? I want to see the next chapter.
I don't know if I'd want to. It might be a little gross. I imagine Anthony and Joanna's marriage doesn't pan out very well.
Yeah, exactly. I think she'll get out the country and he'll lose her because she'll be off doing whatever.
And because he's an idiot.
Oh, yeah. Another bit, again, I don't know if this is me just really overanalyzing, when they sing together, and we'll sail the world and all its wonders, at the end, he sings, and then come back to London someday. But she doesn't say that.
You know, I never noticed that, but that's super interesting.
She just says, she's lovely, beautiful, high note, but she doesn't say that. And I'm like, well, yeah, why the hell would Joanna want to come back to London? She wants to escape. She wants to get away. She wants to be a bird and fly, fly, fly. So that, again, is just, you look into that as their little power play.
And that also, I mean, there's no place like London. I think you can totally frame this show as people with decent human motivations corrupted by this awful place that they are. That them all existing in this place at once is what makes these bad things happen.
Yeah.
Like, nothing anyone does individually is all that inconceivable. Not that it's justified. People want revenge. People want love. People want all these things.
It's all based on extremely human emotions. Extremely human. And that's what's so terrifying, because it's like they say in that final ballad, this could be you. You could be sitting right beside you, because at the end of the day, we're all capable of this. It's just where you go with it. They were once a happy couple. That once was idyllic.
Yeah, and so was Sweeney and Lucy. And so everyone except Mrs. Lovett.
I know. Oh, gosh.
We never learn how poor Nellie Lovett got to be who she is.
She used to be married, obviously, at some stage, we imagine. We never know what happens to him. We never know what happens to Mr. Lovett.
No.
That always fascinates me.
I really enjoy the character of Mrs. Lovett.
Oh, yes.
You know, if you tear apart any piece of text too much, you run into problems.
Right.
Sondheim says Todd has been away for 15 years, and in his annotation says that Lovett is trying to figure out if she remembers him.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that Mrs. Lovett has heard in passing about the existence of Benjamin Barker, who used to live upstairs. It's that Mrs. Lovett once owned the pie shop when her upstairs tenant was Benjamin Barker.
Yeah.
And then Benjamin Barker walks back in and she spends two songs saying, "Who are you?" And once that hits my mind, I find it more difficult to believe some of those things.
But do you think that she was really trying to work it out? Or do you think that she knew all along?
I think they're both different choices.
I know what choice I'd play.
Yeah. Tell me which choice would you play? Because I think I would, were I in the director's shoes, I would leave that up to whoever's Mrs. Lovett.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So I think for me, it's just quintessential that she knows exactly who he is.
Yeah.
What I love about Mrs. Lovett is, there's many things that I can almost kind of relate to her, you know, within reason.
Well, as we've discussed, that's how you spend your Halloween.
Exactly. It's the pie making bit that just really resonates with me. We've all been there when we've had those crushes when we're younger, and they can turn very sour very quickly. I am obsessed with the idea that when he lived upstairs, she was fully in love with him. And at no point did she ever like that Lucy woman, because she was the one who had him. That gives her a lot of motivation.
That does.
Then for, you know, knocking her off.
Yeah, for sure.
And keeping that downplayed. And 15 years is a long time for a crush to brew.
That's true. And then for him to suddenly come back.
Oh, and he's alone.
And you know it.
And that's what I love. I think the second that he steps into the, I mean, it's what he says. The minute I stepped into my shop, you knew. And I think fully she knows, because she has just been waiting and hoping and praying for this moment to happen. And he steps in and suddenly she's like, it can be done. I can get him. And she does.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work because of folly. And it culminates.
Yeah.
In the line in the finale when Mrs. Lovett tells him that she loves him for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
And she says, I'd be twice the wife she was. That tells you all you need to know about what she's been feeling for the whole show.
That's true.
It's been nothing to do with work. It's been nothing to do with, oh, here's a nice fun idea. It's all been about her feelings towards him.
Yeah, that's true. You've convinced me. That is the much stronger.
Another convert. On to the next one.
I would love to read a book called Sondheim on Women, because I think looking at the differences between how Mrs. Lovett is constructed and how Joanna is constructed, two of the three lady characters in this show. And I think Mrs. Lovett has depth and intrigue and intelligence, But Joanna, it is harder to find that.
Yeah.
And I think even the ways as we've talked, like trying to create it or trying to manufacture it, is not entirely text-based. You know, I think you can justify some of it with the text, but there's not a lot of stuff to go on. It doesn't seem like a big jump to create those things, mm-hmm. So it shouldn't be a big jump to have included them in the piece in the first place.
Was that a decision that was made for him? We know for a fact that Sondheim is an intelligent man.
It's true.
And that he would be very well aware when things don't work.
But I would not be surprised if Sondheim struggles writing young women.
But even just purely as like a psychological construct, take gender out of the mix, it doesn't matter. There's so much missing with that character. There's so much missing.
Yeah. Well, she's a character that starts out life as a prop. She starts out as a tiny little baby when we have the flashback. And I don't know, she doesn't get much more dimension until Act Two when she kills Phineas Fogg. Like, that is the strongest decision she makes the whole show.
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen until right at the end.
But could you argue, I'm playing devil's advocate.
Of course.
Could you argue that that's because she has no psychological grounding? She is insane. Her motivations aren't real because she's not real. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. If that were the argument, I would want to look at that in comparison to how we do the beggar woman / Lucy, because she is on the surface insane, you know, just like her daughter, maybe. I think what is missing from this show is honest Judge Joanna interaction. They never have more than maybe a line to each other.
I know.
And the whole pre-story of the show is based around the judge wanting people who look like Todd's wife. We know, and like, of course, he's a creepy dickhole. So that scene might be a little uncomfortable to watch, but even one or two just sentences, just phrases, just something there to look at their interaction where Joanna can say something back or justify her position, mm-hmm. or we can see why she feels like this trapped bird in a cage instead of her just expounding upon it to the audience from her balcony.
And again, devil's advocate, it's not something I agree or feel. Mm-hmm. Could he have done that because he doesn't want you to ever feel that they have a, you know, substantial relationship, that it is all a farce?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but then, no, I'm going to strike my advocacy because even just something in to show that it is a farce, that's so easily writable.
Well, and also all of Joanna's exposition beyond her just character exposition, but her situational exposition is done between the judge and Anthony down underneath her window. And it's two guys talking about her. That's lame.
Yeah.
Sure, Anthony needs to know some of that information. This girl's off limits. I'm the one who's in charge of her. If we ever see you again, I'm going to crush you like this bird.
Mm-hmm.
But you could offload some of that exposition easily into a Judge Joanna moment right in the same song.
Just something.
Maybe the judge, instead of seeing Anthony while walking down the street, comes out of Joanna's window and then has the altercation through the window with Anthony. Like, there's simple ways to flesh out Joanna just a little bit more.
And it would give more to the judge as well. It would make his Joanna, the beautiful flogging scene, it would make that more poignant as well, because you could get to see their relationship rather than just thinking and presuming what it is because he's an old man and she's a young girl.
Exactly. From his perspective, he is guarding her from the world, from people like Anthony.
Mm-hmm.
He goes about it in all the wrong way, but no bad guy wakes up in the morning, twirls their mustache and says, I'm going to do evil today.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone's got their justification.
I wonder if at one point Sondheim wrote, stay with me for the Judge Turpin.
But see, this is where and I think this is a whole nother episode, but Sondheim on women, when you look at Rapunzel and look at Joanna next to each other,
yeah.
I enjoy Rapunzel more, but I think they both have a lot of the same character problems.
100%.
I always wonder, because I come at theater so often from an educator standpoint,
uh-huh.
Three-hour shows are rough when you're a high school teacher,
mm-hmm.
just for a lot of practical reasons. When do you start your show on Wednesday night to get the kids back in math class on Thursday morning with your 3-hour show. If you start at 7, you know, you're done by 10. Kids are out by 10:30 or 11, and then they need to be back at 7:30 the next morning. Like, 3-hour shows are really, really rough from an educator standpoint. And so I always have a gut reaction of like, can't you cut that down? Mm-hmm. But I never know if that's just me, mm-hmm. or if that's true. Because if, you know, when you pay $60, $70, $100, $200 to see a Broadway show, damn well right you want to sit there for 3 hours and get your money's worth, especially if it's a good story.
Yeah.
But it always seems a tad long. Sweeney Todd always seems long.
Yeah, it is. It is. And I guess that's the opera in it. And Stephen Sondheim would hate it saying that, but it's grand. But then the thing is he would say, I'm sure, and I'm putting words into his mouth, I'm really sorry, but he would probably argue that schools shouldn't be doing it.
You know, he wouldn't.
Oh, I love it.
I know this. I know he wouldn't, because this is...
I've got mine right here as well. Let us refer it to the novel. What page?
For the listeners, Jimmy and I are both pulling out our Sondheim. Is this finishing, Manhattan?
This is finishing, yes. Yeah.
If you'd like to follow along with your copy at home... We are on page 334.
That's 334, listeners.
The beggar woman's originally line, "Then how would you like to split me, muff, mister? We'll go jig a jig a little," and I think she says bounce around the bush.
Yep.
Later on, Sondheim says, quote, "To spare the sensibilities of school administrations, I wrote a balderized version for school and squeamish regional productions." And he has the additional lyric here, which is awful. BT dubs.
So bad.
"How would you like a little kiss, dear? I'll be your girlfriend. You won't do better on the docks. Would you like to take me dancing and be my boyfriend and buy me lots of pretty frocks?"
And with that, Lucy has no substance.
That's true. And he does it again. There's another lyric that's cut, and he has an asterisk somewhere.
Yep.
On page 340. Nope, not on page 340. On page 342, it's the beggar woman's line again about... "Open me gate, but dock it straight. I see it lists to starboard."
Yeah.
Where she's talking about his dick. And he has a little asterisk that says, "Needless to say, this verse does not exist in the scripts sent to most schools." So I think, even contrary to what a lot of school administrators believe, Stephen Sondheim would love to see Sweeney Todd done at schools.
I present to you...
Yes?
My counter-argument. He's a businessman.
That's true.
And... he can make a lot of money by schools doing his shows. I mean, what part of you thinks he was happy writing that?
Well, no, but he's...
I think he's playing to the necessary evil of, okay, I can't not let schools do this because I'll come off as a bad person. Are you going to hate me?
I'm not going to hate you, but I think you need to do some... Maybe this is just an American thing, actually. I don't know. If you wanted to do a Stephen Sondheim show in the UK, mm-hmm. who do you write to?
So we have a company called Joseph Weinberger, who are very like MTI.
Okay, because we have MTI, which Musical Theatre International, in conjunction with Stephen Sondheim, developed, you've heard of Into the Woods Jr.?
Of course.
Which, you know... whatever your opinions on Into the Woods Jr., it's just act one of Into the Woods, listeners.
Yep.
But was very, very clearly developed by Sondheim in conjunction with the full version. And, you know, Sondheim went through with all his original stuff and put in... That's really why Our Little World is so prevalent now, because he put it back in for those productions and then recorded a bunch of educational videos of him going through the music... for you, the music teacher, and telling you, here's, you know, watch out for this note. We're on page 7, this is measure 28. This note, you know, this is a rough one right here. And, like, mm-hmm. later on here, and, like, hours and hours of footage of him, Stephen Sondheim, preparing schools to do his shows. So I would argue...
Yes.
...that Stephen Sondheim would love to see Sweeney Todd performed in schools.
Okay, I'll give you that. You win.
I win one. Yes.
We've settled.
It's really cool. It's a neat thing he does because, you know, we all need theater in school.
See, he is a nice man.
So what do you think? Do you, Jimmy, think Sweeney Todd should be performed by, say, high school aged kids? Do you think it's appropriate?
Oh, yeah. I am the biggest advocate of school and regional theater. Oh, my gosh. In every single way. And of course, they should do everything and anything because that's where the love for theater is born. And that's how you have to see shows nowadays, really.
But Jimmy, this show is about murder.
I know, but that's okay, because it's also about human emotion. So that's,
okay.
That's something that all kids feel.
That's next time. Every year, in every school I've been in, there's Sweeney Todd always comes up and someone very quickly says, oh, that's not for high schoolers. And I burn inside.
I know. It's that eternal thing. It's like, oh, come on, adolescents, they know all about it.
Well, and I don't think the moral of Sweeney Todd isn't like, watch out or you too could become an axe murderer.
Uh-huh.
The moral of Sweeney Todd is watch yourself so you don't do something like this.
Yeah.
You know, we're not accusing everyone of being potential meat pie human makers. We're accusing everyone of potentially following through on their revenge to disastrous consequences.
It's a parable for the modern day.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
But she's I love the direction of it, that she's cleaning all of the, like, murder instruments.
Oh, yeah, great. No, it's not what it's about. I'm sorry. Got that one all wrong. No.
Listeners, Jimmy is so spent with me. I wish you could have seen his face.
No, I just won't hear it. It was wrong. And she brings out the tuba.
The tuba's hilarious.
Oh, it's a gimmick.
It's a great gimmick. Patti LuPone with a tuba? How can you go wrong with Patti LuPone and a tuba?
It's not Patti LuPone with a tuba. It's Mrs. Lovett with a tuba. Mrs. Lovett would never play a tuba. Thank you. I'll give her the triangle. I have so much beef.
And she only plays it once, right?
I know. Gimmick. Full-blown gimmick.
But you have that one. I'm going to look it up right now. I just want to see a picture of Patti LuPone with a tuba. Because it's so funny. See, here it is. It's so funny.
We'll put this in the show notes.
Absolutely. So hold on. I got to find a big version of it. There might not be a big version. Oh, it's the best.
Are you messaging me it?
I am.
Oh, Jesus Christ. So, you do. You just look at that. You're like, oh, look, there's Mrs. Lovett and Sweeney Todd.
But see, if you saw that picture, wouldn't you be like, well, I have to find out what this show's about now?
And it tells you nothing about the show. It's a gimmick, Tommy.
It is a gimmick. It is completely a gimmick. It is a very
exactly.
funny
and
gimmick.
Sondheim himself has warned us about gimmicks.
That's true. I understand more, I think I did, than at the beginning of this, why some people on the internet in the comment section of my video are so angry that I chose Patti LuPone.
I mean,
as the correctly cast Mrs. Lovett.
Like you say, there is no right answer.
Right.
Because for me, it would be Imelda Staunton.
So she, remind me, Imelda Staunton is in the one that's reset in like the 1950s?
The 1950s, yep. She has like a little calf diner for you guys over there.
See, for us, a calf is a baby cow. So exactly. I was going to be a little confused.
Right. We don't have them here. We just call it veal.
You don't have cows?
No. Yeah, it's her and Michael Ball. Now, I never saw the production. I've just managed to glean moments from my friends telling me that she's the greatest thing. Various interviews. But everything that she says about Lovett,
mm-hmm.
I'm just like, yes, you've got it. You have got it. And so I saw her in Gypsy, and I'm so grateful that I did, because she gets it. She gets artistic musical theatre. She really understands.
She is just fantastic in everything she does. I wonder, what I am most curious about in this production, and maybe you know, is is there... Casting it in the 1950s seems so much closer to now than the 1850s.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, does it still start Attend the Tale of Sweeney Todd with a big chorus? Do they still come back to life after they're murdered? Like, how much is it a tale we are watching? And how much is it an actual story that's unfolding in front of us? Like that kind of Brechtian separation.
It was very much true in that way. And even to do with the staging was fantastic and very interesting. And the chorus, I think, please correct me if I'm wrong, listeners, but I think the chorus were on stage at all times, watching.
That's cool.
And that's it. That's that box ticked. It was good. It was very, very, very good. A Michael Ball sounds amazing on it as well. Listen, yeah, everyone should definitely go have a listen to it. It's hard to glean performance and emotion from a cast recording, but you can tell there's something good about it. The kind of 1950s gimmicky, I feel that is a little bit gimmicky.
I think that seems perfect.
Oh yeah, it's fun and creative. I'll totally give you that. But I think grounding it in any sort of factual... It needs to be in the 1950s because of this.
Yeah, you could probably make a justification for any decade.
Uh-huh. I think that's it. You know, you could probably use that excuse as, oh, well, this would happen all through time. There are Lovitz and Todds all through time, so let's do it in the 50s. Yeah. And yeah, go for it, that's fine. But you know, there might be people out there who say Julia McKenzie in the original was the greatest Lovitz of all time. And, like, you know,
right,
go for it. I love Julia McKenzie. She probably was great.
There's so many choices. And Mrs. Lovett is such a dynamic, multifaceted character that there are so many right choices you can make. It takes a bunch of actresses to make them collectively throughout history. All right, listeners, I'm sending Jimmy a link to a YouTube video. You yourself will be able to find this YouTube video in the show notes on jimandtomic.com. It is worth it for you to watch this video. Jimmy's going to watch it now.
Is this... Right, okay, I'm ready. This is going to be one of those, like, reaction things. We should add a clip of me reacting. No, don't, because I don't look good.
You have to listen to this.
Right, I'm about to click play.
Disco Sweeney Todd, that's called Disco Sweeney Todd, yeah.
I'm ready.
At long last.
Hooray. Right. Oh, wow. What the hell? I'm full screening it because I think that's what needs to happen. I'm getting so emotional. This is beautiful.
Isn't it fantastic? And you're like, how did I never hear this before? Ladies and gentlemen on the internet, Jimmy is dancing.
This is so good.
It's fabulous.
Like, the cut of the video as well is really
good. Isn't
the
video fantastic? Yeah.
What? Here she comes. Oh my gosh.
Right?
Beautiful. I love it.
Isn't it fabulous?
This needs to be a revival.
It's just, I mean, who, I, yeah. Who sat down and thought, you know what Sweeney Todd needs? Disco.
Yes. Oh my gosh, where is this going to go? Oh, some dialogue. It's the cowbell. I'm at the cowbell. Beautiful. I always hated that one that died.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The one with the beard, I hated
the beard.
Him. I don't know why, I just had irrational hatred. Oh, there she goes. She's jigging.
Yep.
Look at that great direction.
That's wonderful. It's so much better with this song. See, I told you you'd like this.
Oh my god. And honestly, the way that George Heron just did that look. He knows.
Oh, it's...
This is brilliant.
It's wonderful. It's, I mean, that's
oh,
great.
Oh, that's funny.
Listeners, Jimmy is jamming away to this. I think we might lose him. He might just head off to the clubs right now.
I'm ready. Take me there. It may be one in the afternoon, but...
Oh, man. The day I'm out dancing and this comes on, I will be in heaven.
Is this... You were telling me about this Chicago bar? Do
yes.
you play this all the time?
I have never seen this out. I have
right,
only
well,
seen this on the internet.
You need to tell them that
they gotta get on this.
This is why I would go. I want to dance.
To this?
To Stephen Sondheim musical.
The Demon Barber of Fleet Street.
I was hoping for a big end rather than a fade out. Oh my gosh.
Isn't that brilliant?
That's great. Right, what is this? Who just did that?
So, I have been able to find out nothing about this song. It's by a guy named Gordon Grody.
The God.
Or Grody. He's a pop soul singer. He's been like a backing vocalist on things and has very few things out, one of them being this Sweeney Todd.
He's my idol.
I'm sure he was just some...
He's just a singer, isn't he? That's all he is.
You know, as someone who makes stupid musical theater YouTube videos, I'm sure he's just the 70s version of that.
Can we get in contact with him?
Oh my god. Dear internet, if anyone knows how to get in contact with Gordon Grody, I hope that's his name, we would love to just thank him for what he's brought to the world.
If you represent Gordon Grody, he worked for the American Star Academy.
Uh-huh.
So one of you out there must have worked
someone,
with him.
Someone must know who this guy is.
Anyway, well done, whoever you are.
It happened when I was listening to it on my walk home the other day, but, oh, and maybe I'm wrong now that I'm singing in my head. So there's the Wigmaker song, which is the da 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 da.
Tawny, yeah.
Is that also Pretty Women? That must also be someone pretty.
Yeah, it's true, seven da 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 da, but one man to the next. It's true, so love and still
yeah.
inspire, what more things
so,
require, but love, sir, more than love,
what,
sir. I ask
right.
women. Pretty women, I'll keep singing. You
but that's it. So, like, there's a lot of reprise, pre-prize thematic music going on throughout all of Sweeney Todd, but this one struck me as interestingly intentional.
Mm-hmm.
One, I think it's interesting that, of course, Sweeney Todd knows all about hair, because he is a good barber. Beyond being a murderous barber, he also is a good barber, or was.
Yeah.
But then that this is the song he picks... both to sing to Anthony as a plan and to the judge as kind of like it's a plotting song. Both Pretty Women and the Wigmaker sequence are about Todd's plan for revenge, and they're also both about surface level qualities of women.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's Pretty Women or the hair of women. And it's I had never in the bazillion times I'd listened to Sweeney Todd, I had never noticed this one.
No, it's true. Neither had I.
Once I noticed it, it all, you know, seemed so intentional and so obvious. And I, you know, I love when that happens, when you're the 50th time through a show and you're like, oh my God, that thing.
Yeah. That's so interesting.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a very anti-intellectual justification that often comes out around all sorts of literary analysis. Like, did the author really intend that? Did they really mean that? But... so much of it just washes over you until you get it that
mm-hmm.
it doesn't really matter if they meant it or not. The fact that it happened is awesome. And isn't it so much more fun to imagine that they did mean it? That just makes art enjoyment that much better. And here's one clearly where they really, really meant it. You know, Sondheim meant these two songs to draw a parallel.
Yeah, because that is the only time that's reprised, isn't it?
Yeah. It's really cool. The different characters have different themes that come back. You know, London has a theme that comes back.
Mm-hmm.
But there is this kind of generalized Pretty Women theme that once it comes back as the Wigmaker song, it gives it more importance than just... Because without this, Pretty Women as the Judge Todd song is just a distractionary song. It's just, when it's on its own, it's kind of just on the same level as the Beatle and Lovett's Parlor songs.
Yeah.
We're singing this song to pass the time. It is a diegetic song. They're singing to each other. They're singing about women. He's whistling about it in the same way that Lovett's is. But the Wigmaker sequence is not diegetic.
No.
You know, he's using it to describe the ones, but it's also lovely and lilting and about what makes women, quote unquote, pretty.
Well done, Stevie. You good little man, you.
I think that would be a fun thing to map, is the good guy, bad guy-ness of Sweeney. Because, you know, clearly he's a tragic hero in the Shakespearean sense. That is, I think, the meat of the play, pun intended.
Beautiful.
How much you agree or disagree with what Todd is doing right now.
Yeah.
And you're intended to go back and forth. You're intended to be like, oh, yeah. Oh, no. Oh, yeah.
And it's like kind of swinging him off against Love It as well, like when she's ridiculous, but when she's also heartbreaking and
yeah
you're like, ah.
Well, and she's always the mastermind. Todd very rarely has
just say
Tweeny Sod, the Beeman Darver of Street Fleet.
That made me laugh. Tweed.
I don't know if Todd has an original idea until the Wigmaker sequence. He out of gut instinct kills Pirelli.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that's not premeditated. Lovett tells him to wait to kill the judge. Lovett has the idea to bake people into meat pies.
Who has the idea to, they don't really say, do they, before they go into the town to like promote business, they don't say, I've got an idea, let's go into town and promote business. They just kind of go, don't they?
They just kind of go. I don't know who instigates the contest. I bet you Todd instigates the contest.
Isn't that interesting, actually? Because I've kind of analysed their power play, kind of how she's kind of like nudges him in the right directions, but his kind of main task is always judge, 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 judge.
You know, these lines, I've got the script here. These lines must be cut. Because I've never heard them before.
Tell me.
Lights come up. They're in the marketplace. There's the caravan. You know, all that stuff. Todd pointing at the caravan. That's him over there. Mrs. Lovett. Yes, dear. He's always here Thursdays. Todd reading the sign. Haircutter, barber, tooth puller to His Royal Majesty, the King of Naples. Mrs. Lovett. I Latin. All the rage he is. Todd. Oh, sorry. Italian. Todd.
I Latin.
God. Todd says.
Tweed.
Tweed at the Sweeney barber. Todd says, not for long. Mrs. Lovett, oh, Mr. T, you really think you can do it? Todd, by tomorrow they'll all be flocking after me like sheep to be shorn. So that was Todd's idea, to go to market, find the barber, the local barber, challenge him, and that's how he's going to drum up business. That's the plan. That's really interesting. I don't think that's in any version of this I've ever seen. And clearly I didn't read this script closely enough.
It's not, and it's not in Finishing the Hat.
Yeah.
It's not even mentioned.
No, that's really important.
What's going on there?
Yeah, and I don't think, I'm going back to see if they think of anything, because right before that is My Friends.
Yeah.
And I think that just ends with Lift Your Razor High. Yeah, and then we cut to Greenfinch, which I hate, and then Joanna.
Mm-hmm.
And then
the beautiful ballad.
Yeah, then we murder the bird. We talk about Joanna more. And then we're in the marketplace. Yeah, so that's Todd's first idea.
Oh.
He plays the long game that's interesting. He plays the long game even from the beginning. Why not just murder the judge in the street?
Yeah.
But he wants to get his revenge from the beginning. I wish that was played up more.
That's interesting.
Because that would make weight seem less important if we know that he's not like, I'm just going to go invite the judge over. He's like, I'm going to become a barber on the off chance we can convince my arch nemesis to come by, and then that's how I'll murder him. And of course, we're suspending our disbelief through all of that, and that's fine. It's a melodrama.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that he's active there.
Maybe that's why they cut it out. They're like, oh, sugar.
Maybe, yeah. It also, I mean, the whole thing seems very expository as far as the script is concerned. Like, they're reading the sign that the audience can see.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's unnecessary. But the part that it's his plan, and I guess you don't need that because you see it play out, but when she's like, you know, you sure this is going to work, making it his plan, that part's important.
It does a lot for her.
Yeah.
Go figure.
I'm intrigued.
We learned something today, Jimmy.
What could you cut? Let's put our producer hats on. We got to get it down to 2 hours.
Wait.
What are we cutting?
I've already done this.
And ladies and gentlemen, Jimmy is reaching into the oven behind him. Oh, and here's one he's prepared earlier.
Exactly. I think I might throw. But basically, because I've been devising my own production of it for about 5 years.
Uh-huh.
Originally, I was going to do a production of it at the Edinburgh Fringe.
Mm.
Obviously, you know, doing a show that's 2 hours at the Edinburgh Fringe is silly.
Right.
So I had to try and work out how to get it down to an hour and a half. It can't be done.
It's also important.
It's also important.
Unless you're totally looking at it from another perspective, which I'm sure there's a way to do. I just don't know. I don't know how. Like, the things that can be cut are things that they do cut. They cut parlor songs. That makes sense.
Yeah.
It's sad, but it makes sense. Apparently, that was originally intended to be... Lovett was going to try and poison the Beatle.
Oh.
And never got around to it. And the Tower of Bray is supposed to be a drinking song. And you do a shot every time the bell rings.
Oh.
And it was going to be this great comic scene where, like, who's got the cup? And, like, you do the shot each time. And it just never materialized.
That's a shame.
It is. But, you know.
But I think I really like the parlor songs because it's that last bit of scraping tension where you're like.
Yeah.
Ah. And then it comes, you're like, thank God. And then he screams and you're like, oh God.
Yeah.
It's never ending. But I understand it's snippable. Wait is another one. At first glance, you can be like, yeah, okay, why not?
Right.
Snip, snip.
Yeah.
And then I just think you need to go into the song.
Yeah.
It's like you take out the toothpull because you only need one of them.
You can cut out the middle chunk of A Little Priest.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, yeah. Ladies and Their Sensitivities. You can snip bits and bobs out of that. You can, I mean... To be honest, you can kind of cut Kiss Me.
Yeah, that does it. Yeah, I mean, this is where I have the problems with Joanna and Anthony. That song is the only song that establishes their love for each other, but it has no more depth than Anthony showing up at Todd's place saying, I'm in love. That's it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he never, you know why Kiss Me is important? See, this is the problem. Kiss Me sets up Anthony to be all like, I gotta go deal with this now, which causes him to run in on Todd and the judge and interrupt that sequence.
Could he not just run in after seeing her and be like, I've seen this woman that I'm in love with? It's got the same substance.
I think that would make an already vapid character seem even more pointless.
You could cut Amiss. But then it's just what you lose is you lose the illusions and you lose the motifs by doing that, which then lessens the quality of the show.
It's such a nice, tight 3-hour show.
Exactly. That's the thing. And that's impressive to be able to do that without having any dead weight. Well to
It's like what we were babbling on about Lynn however many weeks ago. Everything's important.
Everything.
Don't worry, anyone. We're not cutting Sweeney Todd.
It's okay. You can sleep.
Close your Twitter client now. Don't need to send us angry tweets.
The pitchforks can be put back in the shed.
Close your razors. People. So it's all going to be fine. They are Sondheim's Greek chorus, right? We're not all singing the same thing because inexplicably we all learned the words at Tuesday chorus rehearsal night.
Yeah.
Like in God That's Good, in the tooth pulling sequence, all of the chorus parts are individual.
Mm-hmm.
And like if you look them up, there's weird parts where one of the chorus people sings about Pirelli's Miracle Elixir, like, this would work with George. You know George. Oh, this wouldn't work with George. What are you talking about?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's just this little aside, but everyone's talking at once, so it doesn't matter. And what a wonderful thing to do for your chorus, to give them that content that some, you know, they're not just a group of people. They're all individuals. Here it is.
Yes, come to think of it. I could get some for Harry.
Yeah, nothing works on Harry, dear, bye-bye. Like, those are lines you've never heard before,
yep.
But they're there. And it gives the chorus so much depth instead of all singing the same thing.
You know, as he says, as I will one day get tattooed across my body, God is in the details.
Attend the tale of Sweeney Todd. There is no better way to open a musical.
Yeah.
It sets up how antiquated the show is.
It sets up that it's a morality tale, that we are actors telling you this. It has different meanings in both contexts. At the beginning, it's come to this show. At the end, it's remember this moral, attend.
It's so brilliant. And then he talks about this in fact, yeah, let's do another plug. We're not sponsored in any way, but a wonderful purchase are the Stephen Sondheim books, Finishing a Hat and Looking at a Hat. It is, you know, genius for Hamilton. It's that equivalent, but written by the man himself.
Written by Sondheim, yeah.
Exactly. And there's so many little bits, you know, there's the first drafts and the, you know, they photograph pictures of the first handwritten drafts that he's written of half the songs. And you see all these ideas that he's had, that he's script out, and you're like, oh, they're ideas from God, you know, they've been unused.
Exactly.
Yeah, he talks a little bit about the rhythm of that line. I'm going to find the right words. He says, it's a microcosm of the AABA form. Tommy, did you know that?
Right. Attend the tale. I did know that because I read it in the same book you read it.
But apparently, in its very formality, gives the line a sinister feeling, especially with the sepulchral accompaniment that rumbles underneath it. Straight from the horse's mouth. And it's so true.
This is, he says it, I wrote it in here. This is straight from Stephen Sondheim's mouth. God.
It's Tweeny Sweet.
Tweeny Sweet. I'm doing so well on the articulation today.
You did good.
Straight from Stephen Sondheim's mouth. What Sweeney Todd really is a movie for the stage. I think if you asked Sondheim what his favorite part about the show is that it's the underscoring. I bet you that is the reason he said yes to Warner Brothers when they wanted to make the Johnny Depp Tim Burton movie. And it has so little to do with Johnny Depp or Tim Burton and so much more to do with how Sondheim feels about movie scores. And the fact that he finally got to see this piece realized as the movie he wanted it to be. I wonder how happy he was.
I know. I don't think he's ever said.
Yeah. Well, and he is a professional through and through, which means he never will. You never want to disparage a product. He may even be legally obligated to never disparage a movie that has his name on it. But I think it missed the bar in a couple places that it could have. I think it has wonderful imagery.
Mm-hmm.
I think the movie is beautiful to watch.
Absolutely.
I think it's definitely scary in some right ways. Watching Helena Bonham Carter die inside that furnace at the end is terrifying. That's real scary.
The gore is fantastic. It's really gory, and they don't, again, to use a pun, they don't mince their words, which is great.
But some of it does not achieve everything that the stage production does.
But it's brought it to the masses, and everyone knows, oh, Sweeney Todd, that's that Johnny Depp one, yeah? And I'm like, yeah, fine, it is.
And most importantly, you get to hear Alan Rickman sing.
Which is a joy for everyone. I think we should make a little sound clip of us telling people to review and to comment and talk to us.
Yeah, can it be? So Jimmy, our podcast did not end very succinctly last time with me making jokes about it ending suddenly. And we didn't have a chance to tell people that they should leave a review of this podcast on iTunes.
Please do, because we actually generally want to know what people think.
If you have feedback for us or want to let us know things, our Twitters are on the website, jimandtomic.com. It's in whatever you're listening to right now. You can find it on there.
Yeah.
We have really extensive show notes, which you should look through. And you can tweet stuff at us. And who knows, we may talk about it on the next podcast.
Yeah, because some people have been, and that's been really, really nice. And like, I want to know what we're doing wrong.
Yeah. Well, don't, do you know what I mean? Careful opening that door.
But at the same time, I like open feedback. I'm all about feedback. So please let us know what you want to hear.
Please, please let us know what you want to hear. Please let us know what we can
do.
By
now you've realized we can talk about anything.
We can talk about anything for hours and hours and hours. I think there's such a vacuum in the world of musical theater discussion.
Discussion, that's the word, Thomas.
Let's fix that. Let's talk about musical theater. Internet.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Let's start a revolution.
We want to talk with you. If you want to talk with us, do it. There's a local hardware store in Illinois called Menards. Right. They have
a commercial jingle, and it goes, save big money. You'll save big money when you shop Menards. And it's the breakers breaking the Quaker. Yeah, see? Wasn't that a good...
That's very valid. Thank you.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.